Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day that you want to hear it, and our shows are archived as well. santafe.radiocafe.org is made possible by Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget to retune your radio dials. We are moving to 101.1 FM. That is our new frequency. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Matt Hanifin about boomerangs and what they are and how they work. And we're also going to be talking to Kelly Fowler of Girls, Inc. Right now, I would like to welcome Danny Phillips. He is a violinist with the Orion String Quartet, and the quartet is here as part of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, playing a large number of the Beethoven string quartets, which we're going to be talking about today. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Beethoven wrote 16 string quartets, the first when he was in his 20s, the last the year before his death. Do the quartets give us a sense of Beethoven's total musical output in their progression from early to late?
Absolutely. Beethoven seemed to care about the string quartets at least as much as the piano sonatas, which is, of course, what he was able to play himself. So he seemed to take his greatest care in string quartets. In fact, all his latest pieces, right before he died, were all string quartets.
Now, what is the typical form of the string quartet that Beethoven, I guess you would say, sort of inherited? Were they always four movements, the first movement slow, the second movement, first movement fast, second movement slow, and so on?
Almost all of them are that way. And he took that model from Papa Haydn, who kind of invented the whole idea of string quartets as such.
Is that right? Haydn invented them?
Well, there were some people wrote quartets sort of, oh, by the way. And, of course, in any kind of orchestra in Baroque times, there was usually two violins, viola, and cello, along with the double bass doubling the cello. So that idea was sort of normal. But the idea of a string quartet was really kind of Haydn's thing. He had a resident quartet at his gig at the court Esterhazy, and he kind of enjoyed exploiting that form. So he took it from the usual, like earlier times you'd expect the first violinist, which would be sort of like the soprano in a choir, to take the tune most of the time, and the others would be sort of mostly accompanimental. As Haydn developed, he sort of started to get more of an equality of the voices. Beethoven and Mozart both took a look at those and were kind of blown away by it, and they sort of took the form yet further.
So in what ways did Beethoven take it further?
Well, he made the pieces longer. As he developed, he got even more and more independence of the voices and more sort of complicated interaction between all four voices.
We're going to hear the first movement of one of the early quartets, the Opus 18, number 6. And I chose this one because you played it for a group of fourth graders and got a wonderful response from a little girl.
Yeah, the little girl said it was like a bunch of four people in battle or something like that.
Yeah.
Battling each other.
A battle among the four instruments.
Yeah, which we really liked, because when you listen to any chamber music, in quartets in particular, one of the things you can get out of it is not just sort of sitting back and relaxing and hearing the tune, but especially if you're there live, you actually see the interaction between the players, how like a snippet will come in the top and a snippet will come in the bottom, and stuff in the middle will be doing other things. And so it's kind of it's like a four-way sports match of some kind.
Does it feel like that when you're playing?
Oh, sure. And that's one thing that we try to bring out. is trying to highlight who has the most interesting part at any given time, and that may change from second to second. So that's what makes it exciting, not just hearing, sitting back and relaxing and listening to the tune so much.
Well, I think the sort of stereotype about classical music being relaxing is something that we have to just say is not necessarily true, especially with the Beethoven string quartets.
It's, yes, we joke about that. Gee, that was a lovely, relaxing thing. Whereas, like, we're sweating bullets, and the more we work on them, the more we find that we're being like shoved around emotionally. The thing with Beethoven, especially, is he kind of takes what's your normal tolerance for what's emotionally comfortable and stretches it, like, beyond what you're normally used to. In fact, the whole idea of the classical form anyway, as opposed to the Baroque form, which is, I guess, why Baroque is so popular, you hear one movement and it has one feel to it the whole time, pretty much. And it's very nice to listen to that way. Like Vivaldi concerto. A fast one will be, you know, lovely and brilliant the whole time. In classical form, the idea is to have stark contrast in the same movement. And Beethoven, that's, in a way, that's what made him the great classic composer, is that he took, there's like wildly varying moods that change so fast. So it makes it very uncomfortable to play, actually.
And it makes it very interesting to listen to, especially in a live situation.
Well, exactly. That's when you pick up the interaction the most keenly, is when you're there able to see that, oh, that's the second violin playing that. No, it's not the first violin playing that.
Right.
On a recording, you may not pick that out.
A recording, unless you're a violinist, you definitely wouldn't pick it out, probably most likely.
Yeah. And then, of course, as when we're playing in it, we try to make it sound similar in a certain way. But when you're there, you know that it's different.
Let's listen to this Opus 18, number 6, string quartet by Beethoven. And let's see. And this is played by the Weg Quartet, and who are was your mentor.
Well, Sándor Weg was very important, both for me and my brother. My brother went to Salzburg to study with him.
And you and your brother are the two violinists in the Orion Quartet.
Yes, sorry. And so he opened up worlds of not just good technique or good phrasing, but it's sort of whole philosophy of playing with economy and having the courage to play not always beautifully, because some music isn't beautiful, and that kind of thing. So he was very a very inspiring, charismatic character, and very important for us.
So let's hear the first movement of the String Quartet No. 6, Opus 18. This is the first movement of one of the early Beethoven string quartets. Does it sound like a battle to you?
Well, I have to admit my mentor plays it a little more sedately than we do.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interpreting these quartets is... Beethoven at one point was asked to put metronome marks, which indication of exactly how fast it's supposed to go. So his metronome marks... for this piece are a little unhelpful, because what he wrote was insanely fast.
Oh, really?
Something like that, which is unbelievably fast. And we tried it that way. I'll be able to see. And I know some groups have recorded and try to be faithful to that. But it always sounds like Keystone Cops. Like it's like it's silly.
And so you have to interpret it to
right.
be listenable.
So, I mean, he did these metronome marks later on when I guess he was trying to be, he was convinced by a publisher or performers, like, please tell us how it's supposed to go. But we found from working with live composers today that they have no idea. In fact, a work we did here, premiered here, commissioned for us by the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, a quartet by the avant-garde composer Per Norgard, who's Danish. We got the score, and there's one place was written one half note, which is supposed to get two beats, but one half note is equals 132. That's which is like bump 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 like that.
Right.
And we had many notes to play inside that, and we tried it. We couldn't really do it. And it was like, it sounded just ridiculous, unintelligible. So luckily he was alive, so I called up his answering machine in Denmark, you know, which we could have done for Beethoven. And his reply to my answering machine was, oh, you've got me where it hurts. I can never get this right and take into account your scratchings back and forth with your bows. Perhaps try it at 104, just a lot slower. So we're kind of relieved that we didn't, like, kill ourselves.
Well, that's interesting. So the composer doesn't even take into account the necessity of arm movement and technique of a violinist.
That's just what he had in his head. And then when we saw him in person here, he sang it through. It was actually quite lovely, and we clocked it at around 96, just like two-thirds as fast. Anyway, so we did it that way in the performance. He was very happy with the way we played that, especially that part. So we asked him at the party after, are you going to change the metronome marks? He said, no, I had it my idea a certain way. So, you know.
So when he's gone, people like you can't call the answering machine and everyone has to do this problem all over again.
No, these poor people are going to kill themselves trying to be faithful to the composer. You know, we've run into this over and over again. Composers seem to be the least qualified to tell us how their music's supposed to go, at least in terms of how they notate it.
We're talking to Danny Phillips from the Orion String Quartet, who is here through the beginning of next week with the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival. Well, that's an interesting question about Beethoven. Did he know? I mean, some of this work is very difficult to play. We're going to be playing some more of the quartets later in this program. Did he know how difficult this work was?
He did. He didn't care.
He didn't care.
He didn't care. I forget the exact quote, but his first violinist who played all his stuff, Chopin Zig, complained, I think it was by 59 number one, which has some ridiculously hard things in it. He complained to Beethoven about it, and he said, what do I care for your little fiddle when I'm getting inspiration direct from God?
Right.
He was a little self-important guy, but still, he tried to make it possible. I mean, all the notes that he wrote are possible to play, but sometimes it's awfully difficult.
So your group called the Orion String Quartet recorded a 3 CD set called Beethoven Middle String Quartets. How would you characterize the middle period of Beethoven's output, composed in the first decade of the 19th century? How did he build on and break from the earlier work, the early quartets?
Well, the earlier ones sound, if you don't know better, you're pretty sure it's a sort of a, how should I say, it's a rougher version of Haydn and Mozart. But you would sort of place it in that time. The later quartets are much more expanded. They go much, much further in their emotional reach. And they do, technically, they found ways of expanding the whole experience. So it's sort of like hearing an early Beethoven symphony and then hearing the Eroica symphony, which becomes a much more gigantic kind of construction. So 59 number 1 is actually one of the longest quartets he ever wrote, which is about 40 minutes long. Previously, I think the longest one was Mozart's quintet in C major for a quartet with an extra viola, which is maybe like half an hour.
These quartets, were they all commissioned? Was there a patron who paid for each one?
Yes, someone commissioned each one.
And so did the, I mean, it's, you've got a client, you know, yeah. I mean, it's a relationship. Does the person say that, who's commissioning the work, I want a half an hour piece, or I want, it's got to be less than that, you know, do they have strings attached?
I think mostly the gig was to write a certain number of pieces. And his Opus 18s were very successful, and in the middles, most were pretty successful too. And this poor guy, Galitzin, this Russian count, commissioned some of the late quartets, expecting to hear some lovely Opus 18s. Actually, he wasn't that thrilled with it, actually, because he got some pretty weird-sounding stuff, which must sound particularly weird with these people playing it for the first time. Like, you know, what? The old man has gone off the deep end, I'm sure they were thinking.
There was a story somewhere in that I was reading yesterday about some musicians saw the sheet music for the Beethoven and thought it was a joke. They just started laughing for some of the string quartets.
I'm sure they did. Especially, like, well, the classic one, that would be the Grosse Fuga, which is actually the original last movement of Opus 130. So I think at the first performance, actually the rest of Opus 130 was very successful because a lot of it is actually very appealing and has this great movement called the cavatina, which everyone loves. I mean, you can't help but be moved by it. Anyone could at the first hearing. And then this fugue happens in the last movement, which is like totally cacophonous and apocalyptic and in nature. And I'm sure the first performance sounded pretty bad. I'm sure. It takes a lot of work to understand it and try to play without, because you're tempted just to break your instruments in half and play it because it's so powerful. But there's some pretty crazy stuff. And it sounds more modern than most modern music does today, honestly.
So. We're talking to Danny Phillips of the Orion String Quartet. You've been playing, violin since you were a child. You come from a musical family. Your father's a violinist. Your brother's a violinist. You've been playing in quartets for a long time. You must have been playing a lot of these, if not all of these, Beethoven string quartets over and over again, over years, over decades. What do they yield to you that you might not have gotten the first 50 times you played them?
They seem to be an unending, unending challenge. As soon as you sort of get close to something, the music seems to demand even greater resources, personally, technically, and emotionally, every time. And kind of the way Beethoven does it too is actually quite simple, in a certain kind of way. Other composers try to create a more advanced effect by getting more and more crazy with the harmonies and more ornate and interesting with the melodies and that kind of thing. He actually kind of stuck to basic chords that we're used to, like in pop music. And he was a great admirer of Handel, who also actually wrote quite simply. I think of the Hallelujah Chorus, for instance, which like that, which is very simple, and the material is very simple and easy to get. Yet it's like still today one of the most magnificent, stirring things, much more moving to many people than some Mahler symphonies and whatever, which get very complicated in the harmonies. So even though some of Beethoven's contemporaries, like Spohr and Hummel and other people you may not have heard of, were writing more advanced modulations and harmony, he stuck to these basic kinds of harmonies and kind of made them mean something cosmic. So if you want to go on, I can't really sing, but you get these basic chords you're used to, and somehow the way he arranges it makes it sound like huge. And then if he gives you a harmony that you don't expect, it's like you'd be like, you know, hit by a ton of bricks somehow, the way he arranges it. But that's what's there in the music to be articulated by the performers. You can play it in a way that doesn't actually have any impact. But you see that it's there. You try to somehow, with your sound and with your change, personal change of mood and personal power, you try to get behind what he wrote.
And all four of you have to be on the same page with it.
Right. We have to pick that up. We have to either just discuss it in rehearsal or just demonstrate in our playing. And the way we work, too, we don't fix everything so concretely. So we have plenty of room for improvisation. It's not exactly the right word, but we can be more free to, if something overtakes us, to go ahead, and we're all
in performance.
In performance, and we expect each other to pick it up.
Well, let's hear the the string quartet number 9, Opus 59, the fourth movement, Allegro Molto, very fast. Let's hear that, and we'll talk about it in a moment.
Thank you.
String Quartet playing Beethoven's String Quartet number 9, Opus 59, the fourth movement, and Danny Phillips is joining us from the Orion String Quartet. How long has this quartet been playing together?
This coming up is our 20th season, and that's one reason we wanted to do a Beethoven cycle here, because it's something we've been working on for the last 20 years.
And it's very interesting that Beethoven's cycle, the cycle of the 16, well, you're not playing all 16, but you're playing a lot of them, string quartets, you're playing half of them over a period of a few days, are incredibly popular. It's sold out. It's like the Rolling Stones. I mean, you did one time in Pittsburgh, I was reading the whole cycle of the 16 string quartets, and it was totally sold out. People were clamoring for tickets. People came obsessively to every single one. What's going on? What is the nourishment that people are getting from these that they might not get from other forms of art and life around them?
Well, I'm very pleased that Beethoven is kind of sells nowadays. Anyway, that is because what we're getting seems to be what some of what everyone else is getting. But I think that's what it is. It's that expanded emotional content. That it takes you outside the realm of, way outside the realm of what's normal, normally expressive. Just for instance, we're talking in a very, nice tone of voice. But what if I talk like this all the time?
And I answered like this.
Yeah, it's all right. That's socially weird. However, music is a chance where you're supposed to do that and way more, like this last movement.
You clearly don't come from a Sicilian family.
Right.
Where people talk like that all the time.
Yeah. Well, but even so, like the way that the movement we just heard, we can't just sort of walk around like that without being committed. But there is a chance to kind of go nuts.
Now, this music does cut across, in terms of the listeners, all boundaries discernible of age and class and everything else.
Yeah, our first Beethoven cycle was at Lincoln Center in New York, and it was in 2000, so the concept was a free gift on the new millennium to New York City. And so the concerts were free, but you had to get tickets. And then, I guess, the economy was in better shape, and the Chamber Society of Lincoln Center was able to take full-page ads out in the New York Times, but also in El Diario and the Chinese paper and the New York Post, which never has classical music stuff ads. But all it said was Lincoln Center, just what you just said. Each concert was honoring a different children's arts organization in New York City. But they were to be six free concerts. We also gave 100 tickets to each place, each of the children's arts organization, which they all used, and they all came. But anyway, it was about 2 weeks before the concerts were to start in May of 2000. The tickets became available at 11 at the Alice Tully Hall box office. At 8 a.m., there was a line waiting for it to open. By 12:30, every ticket was gone. And every concert had a line around the block with blue police barricades and the whole thing waiting for turnbacks. And so we therefore had an audience that wasn't the usual concert goer who couldn't be bothered suffering through the line getting the tickets. And we gave very few tickets out ourselves. We each gave like maybe just our family and pretty much just our family.
Right.
So the usual concert goers didn't go. We had this whole other crowd.
So wasn't the older crowd with their tuxedos or whatever?
No, not at all. And they clap between the movements, which they're not supposed to do. But of course, at Beethoven's day, it was normal to do.
Was it?
Totally. That whole clapping, not clapping thing, that museum kind of atmosphere is something new in the last, in this century, or the last 60, 70 years. It was normal. For instance, the second movement of Opus 130, which is a very fast and very appealing movement, there was so much applause after that performance that it had to be encored twice before the audience allowed them to continue. That's where the word encore comes from. Not we want to hear another piece, but we want to hear that again,
right,
until we're really happy with it. The days before recordings, that's you heard the music. Oh, let's hear that again. And again, before we go on, so that was normal. But we had microphone at the situation in the concert. So if there was a particular movement that was very transcendent and quiet, we asked them, please don't applaud in that case. And then we had the most quiet audience we've ever heard in New York, ever. So I don't know who everybody was that came, but it proved to us that first of all, Beethoven's music reaches because there were hoots and hollers for late Beethoven quartets, which I'm sure Beethoven would have finally found vindication for, since they weren't that well accepted in his day. And so it proves that classical music is not dead, it's just way too expensive.
Indeed. We're talking to Danny Phillips from the Orion String Quartet. Let's talk about the late quartets. You're going to be playing two of them tonight, and unfortunately, I think the whole Beethoven program here, even here in Santa Fe with the Chamber Music Festival, is sold out. But you can, ladies and gentlemen, call 983-2075 to see if there are any tickets or if there's even any room on the waiting list. But you're going to be playing tonight the String Quartet number 16, Opus 135, which we have a little bit of music here to listen to as well. These were composed, the late ones were all composed when Beethoven was deaf. He'd been deaf for some time. And I've been trying to imagine being a composer and composing year after year when you're deaf. Where does the drive come from? It's not for yourself anymore. You can't hear it. It's not about the pleasure of hearing it. I mean, Beethoven said that he was inspired by the spirit. Can you put yourself in the composer's shoes?
Well, composer writes because of that need to create, and having a ongoing inspiration and vision, like anyone else, like any other artist does. And mostly, if you're a genuine artist, whether you're a performer or composer, you're doing it not for success, but you're doing it for your own personal something, whatever that is.
Personal or transpersonal.
Yeah, I mean, you have your own, whether it's a spiritual quest inside or some artistic thing, but it's for your own evolution, let's say. And all the best performers that I've talked to, like Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Apps, they say they're just grateful to be working, so they have the chance to do this. They're not doing it in order to make themselves successful. It's not their motivation, and I'm sure it wasn't Beethoven's motivation either. Everyone likes to be recognized, and Beethoven had a big ego, and he was put out when he didn't get recognized like anybody else. But it came from his personal need. And I sometimes wonder whether his deafness didn't liberate him in some way of having to hear how it sounded. Because especially as you get to the late quartets, first of all, what's interesting is all his earlier pieces were always composed at the piano, as many pianist composers do. So he would often write even the quartets out in piano score, so he could sort of play it, and that's how he conceived it. The late quartets, he just started with a manuscript paper with four staves. So you can see that there's actually independent voices, and sometimes what used to be in the cello part, he just, all right, I'll just move that up, click, 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 up to the first violin part instead, and I'll move what's usually in the viola part down to the cello.
So the process of composing it visually, as opposed to composing it at the piano, made for different music.
Yeah, so the four parts have a more independence from each other. So in that way, in certain kinds of ways, it's technically easier than the earlier ones, which are more exposed and the ensemble is more obvious.
Well, we're going to have to go in just a moment, but let's just end with hearing the slow movement, the third movement from the string quartet, number 16, opus 135. We haven't heard a slow movement yet. What is it like to play this?
Well, every time by the end, it becomes one of those transcendent experiences. It's hard to describe what the mood is, but I guess it's somewhere between romantic and spiritual, or perhaps both. It's actually secretly a theme in Variations, although it's hard to pick that out because it's so well disguised. And probably if you didn't know who was composing it, you might have thought this was Mahler on his best day, 100 years later.
Right. Well, Danny Phillips, I want to thank you so much for being here with us. Danny Phillips is from the Orion String Quartet and is here as part of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival playing a large number of the Beethoven string quartets over the next few days. It's wonderful to have you on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
And we're going to go out with the string quartet number 16, third movement. I'd like now to welcome Matt Hanifin. He is with Science Toy Magic at tiny little store over in the San Busco Center. And he is, among many other things, a boomerang man, and you are going to be teaching free boomerang lessons. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, a boomerang is a thing that you throw and it comes back to you. It's a physically an amazing thing. It's metaphorically also an amazing thing. But how do you suppose the first Aboriginal Australian ever thought of making... I mean, how in the world did somebody even invent a boomerang?
Well, probably at least 11,000 years ago. At least 11,000 years ago, probably, the Aboriginal people in the northeastern part... I'm sorry, the eastern part of Australia created the first boomerangs, and then we have ones that are carbon dated back that far. But the boomerangs were originally... several different kinds of devices that were used for hunting and other kinds of skills. The returning boomerangs were mostly just for amusement, and the free boomerang lessons will be for amusement.
Right, not for hunting. Well, I suppose if you spend a lot of your time hunting, you would make a whole lot of tools, and if one of them came back to you, that would be how it got invented, just through trial and error.
Mary Charlotte, that's exactly what I think, that through trial and error they were horsing around with things that flew straight and were used for hunting game called hunting boomerangs, and the returning boomerangs that we'll be throwing at the free boomerang lessons this Sunday are just for fun, just for sport.
You have also invented your own boomerang and patented it?
Yes. One of my toy inventions, is a boomerang for blind people that I patented back in the 80s. and this is the first of all of my my patented inventions.
When you say boomerang for blind people.
It's a soft, spongy boomerang with a buzzer in it called the Radar Rang. We no longer have those available for folks, but out at the free boomerang lessons, we have soft, spongy boomerangs that even kids down to the age of four can throw.
I actually have one of them. It looks like a little three-leaf clover, and you toss it like a frisbee, and it comes back to you if it doesn't hit the wall of your house first.
Yes, we do have lots of indoor boomerangs also, and those are similar to the outdoor foam boomerangs. The indoor boomerangs circle around in about a 4 or 5 foot circle, and a three-year-old or over can throw the indoor boomerangs.
Or over, in my case. Matt Hannafin, you are teaching boomerang lessons. Is this the typical sort of L-shaped Australian one that we're familiar with?
I will have many different kinds of returning boomerangs at the intersection of Artist Road and Washington on Sunday at 8 o'clock to throw.
The intersection of Artist Road and Washington, that's sort of Fort Marcy Park area?
When we meet there at the intersection of Artist Road and Washington. And we have the free boomerang lessons Sunday at 8 o'clock, from 8 o'clock until 9:30. And the types of boomerangs, the elbow-shaped boomerang that you mentioned, as well as about 20 other styles of returning boomerangs, as well as boomerangs have lights in them. So if we needed to, we could throw boomerangs at night if it suddenly went dark on us.
At 8 in the morning.
At 8 in the morning.
In which case, if it went dark at that time, you'd have far worse problems than whether or not your boomerang came back.
Do you think so?
We're talking to Matt Hannafin. You're also a national boomerang competitor.
Yes, I've competed in 4 U.S. national boomerang tournaments, and I try to bring the practice that I've had in order to help students learn how to throw returning boomerangs. By the way, this is just for fun, and we provide all of the boomerangs. So you just show up on Sunday at 8 o'clock at the intersection of Artist Road and Washington, and I'll try to use, if I remembered anything from the national competitions where we would compete in skills like accuracy, making difficult catches, having a boomerang that takes a really long time to come down, and having fast catch boomerangs that come around really, really, really fast.
So you'll be demonstrating all of this as well.
Well, usually the customers
participants.
Participants. The students are usually too busy playing with the boomerangs, and I'm usually not demonstrating a lot myself. But sometimes people want some demonstrations of some fancier boomerangs, and sometimes I do that too.
Matt Hannafin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Matt Hannafin is with Science Toy Magic, which is a store in the San Busco Center, and he will be on the corner of Washington and Artist Road on Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. His number is 820-7264 if you have any more questions. We're going to take another little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Kelly Fowler from Girls, Inc.,
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
It's great to have you. What is Girls, Inc.?
Well, Girls, Inc. is part of a national nonprofit organization that the mission is to inspire all girls to be strong, smart, and bold. So what that means here in Santa Fe is that we offer summer and after-school programming for girls that allows them to learn skills that help them overcome obstacles that exist for girls and women in society.
What kind of obstacles are you facing among the girls here in Santa Fe? What do you see?
Well, we see, as you may know, New Mexico has a high rate of teen pregnancy. Kind of across the nation, the economic barrier, this glass ceiling is still in existence to some extent, and just a lot of other gender stereotypes that exist.
So what kind of activities do you do with the girls to make them strong, smart, and bold, as opposed to weak, dumb, and timid?
Well, we have a lot of different programs. They're nationally researched from National Girls, Inc. Some of them include a program called Preventing Adolescent Pregnancy, Economic Literacy, and they're all age-appropriate. So all girls are going through these programs, but the youngest girls, for instance, in economic literacy may be learning to count money, and the older girls may be learning to apply for jobs or how to interview.
In terms of the strong part, do you have physical activities as well?
We do. We have a program called Girls in Courage, which allows them to learn to take healthy risks and to know the power of their own bodies. And they've done ropes courses, GPS scavenger hunts, and then they also...
They learn how to use GPS?
They do. It was a great time. They went out and did a whole scavenger hunt around the city.
And you have an event coming up which we want to make sure to let people know about.
Yes, it's our Arts and Crafts Show, our 35th annual Arts and Crafts Show this weekend on the Plaza.
And are the arts and crafts made in part by the girls?
Well, we have over 250 artists from New Mexico and all over the U.S., and then one of the booths actually will feature photography from our girls.
And the other artists are people who have donated and who want to support Girls Inc.
Yes, all the proceeds from the booth sales go to Girls Inc. It's our number one fundraiser. And then these artists are professionals and they're selling their own work. So,
what kind of results have you seen? What kind of changes? I assume that you work directly with the girls.
I actually work on the more marketing and development side, but I do see the girls on a day-to-day basis. And I can tell you just in my experience that it is amazing to see even a girl from the beginning of the summer to the end. She feels more empowered and like she can find her own voice.
What does that look like?
We have a lot of girls. We have a very diverse population. And for some girls, they've never had an environment where they feel like they can speak up or even that they can be safe. So we pride ourselves in having an environment where the girls can feel safe and speak their minds. And we've seen really big transformations in a couple of girls that have been more confident and actually verbally told us that they really feel safe at Girls Inc. and are so thankful to have this place, kind of their space.
I took a self-defense course once, and one of the things I learned there is that the main part of self-defense is verbal. And people who are able to defend themselves, a lot of it is just simply being able to stand tall and say no.
Exactly, and that's something we work on. Our all-girl environment really helps women to find their own voice and to speak up, whereas in larger society they may not have had the outlet to do that. So we really want to encourage girls in this safe environment to find their own voice and then go out into the world and use it.
Well, Kelly Fowler from Girls Inc., once again, when is the Arts and Crafts event?
It's this Saturday and Sunday on the Plaza.
Thank you so much for being with us, Kelly.
Thanks
Fowler
for having
from
me.
Girls Inc. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. And if you've missed anything in the program, like phone numbers or event times or anything like that, you can certainly email me and I will do my best to get this information to you. You can also leave a message at 428-1528, although that is not preferable. Email is better. We are also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my website. You can hear the show anytime you want to listen. Shows are archived. All this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. We'll include a visit from local pianist John Rangel and possibly even some live music. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Friday, Robert Knott. We're also going to be speaking to Jamil Jaffer from the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, about some very important stuff that's going on in the United States today. So all that and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista, baby.